live from the great American Northwest. It's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop
what you're doing. Before about a week ago, I had never heard of a little town called Burns Mill, Missouri. I understand that it's somewhere near East St. Louis. I'll have to double-check that. In any case, Burns Mill, Missouri came to my attention because the following story I'm about to share with you, which refers to something that may come about that I earnestly hope happens. Dateline Burns Mill, Missouri, October 18th. The headline is Man Protests Treatment by Challenging Cop to MMA Fight. MMA, of course, refers to mixed martial arts. What used to be called pancration. It's a combination of striking and grappling. And, of course, it's probably the fastest-growing professional sport today. Rich Stevens was an offensive lineman for the Oakland Raiders in the 90s, but he's going on the offensive now against a Burns Mill police, against a Burns Mill Police Department. That's bad writing. It should be against the Burns Mill Police Department or against a Burns Mill police officer. He claims Officer Tim Walker mistreated him during a traffic stop, so he took out a full-page ad in a paper challenging him to a fight. He would plan to sell tickets and donate proceeds to Backstoppers. That's a charitable outfit. I'd never heard of it before either. He is also driving around his pickup truck with a giant sandwich board sign on both sides asking, quote, what's short, fat, and round all over? The next line says a Burns Mill cop. Everywhere I drive this truck, people honk their horns and give me thumbs up. It's been overwhelming, said Stevens. His idea of a joke is no laughing matter to the Burns Mill Police Department. Now, let me stop right here. I don't think that this is intended as a joke. I think he's calling out somebody who he sincerely believes mistreated him. Here's the backstory a little bit on the occasion of conflict here, if you will. Last July, there was a traffic stop in Burns Mill, which I'm given to understand is a notorious speed trap. I had at least one person write into me and tell me that he has been stopped on multiple occasions in Burns Mill. Another person described how apparently the tax farmers, the armed tax farmers for the Burns Mill Police Department, literally have their cars lined up and ready to deploy in order to snag people for traffic violations. And there is not yet an identifiable quota that I've been able to discover, but the police department does collect a fairly healthy percentage of every ticket that is written. So you're dealing here once again with a form of revenue farming. They're treating the town as a revenue ranch, and they're shearing the sheep who happen to blunder through the town. Last July, Mr. Stevens, who is a resident of Jefferson County, Missouri, was in a traffic stop. He's a large guy. He looks like he's a fairly inoffensive fellow. He's about 6'7", but he's not by any means what one would call physically prepossessing at this point in his life. No doubt in the early 1990s, he was probably hell on wheels. Right now, he looks like a big, strong, easygoing guy who probably on account of his stature, and I'm guessing the fact that he didn't avert his eyes, tug on his forelock, and otherwise behave like a chastened serf, provoked unease on the part of the officer who detained him. And so Officer Walker was summoned to the scene. From what I understand, Officer Walker kicked Rich Stevens' feet out from beneath him, then handcuffed him. And of course, because you're dealing with two officers and both of them have guns, you're dealing in a situation where there is an imbalance of power. And that's, of course, how a situation of that sort is designed. There's supposed to be an imbalance of power. The first rule of thumb for police officers and other bullies is never fight fair. If you're dealing with somebody who's big enough to take care of himself in any situation where he's paired up against somebody, then, of course, you're going to get somebody else and both of them are armed. And so it wasn't merely a question of this guy feeling like he'd been treated brusquely or he'd been given a ticket unfairly. He ended up in jail over the weekend. No criminal charges were filed that I've been able to learn about against Mr. Stevens, but he had to pay $160 to get his truck out of impound. And so you're dealing here with somebody who has a grievance, and he figures that something has to be done by way of redress. And so his preferred avenue of redress is to say to Mr. Johnny Law, why don't you ditch the costume jewelry and take off your gun and go at me mano a mano? You know, let's throw down in a neutral environment in which you're not going to have the benefit of the presumption here of qualified immunity, or you're going to have the advantage of having a firearm, and you're not going to be able to press charges against me, which are fundamentally spurious from the common law and constitutional perspective, press charges against me for the supposed crime of resisting your aggression against my person. You know, why don't you demonstrate, rather, for the purpose of public edification, just how tough you are as an individual rather than as somebody who represents the state's punitive priesthood? That's basically what's going on here. It's not a joke by any means, to continue with the story now. My opinion is it's borderline harassment and making a threat against a law enforcement officer, said Chief Ed Locke of the Burns Mill Police. Once again, they're defining this in terms of a threat to officer safety, which is the highest and holiest priority for people who are in law enforcement. That is the first preoccupation. That is their defining consideration in any circumstance. Now, you're not dealing here with a threat. You're dealing with an invitation. If he said that he was going to hunt this guy down and shoot him in his sleep, that's a threat. It's a pretty horrible thing to say. This is an invitation. And there was a time, and I think it was a more civilized time, quite frankly, when it was permissible to fight duels. I'm not thinking in terms of duels to the death because, as I've said before, I don't want to kill another human being under any circumstance. There are circumstances in which I might be forced to do so, but I pray literally every day that when finally my exhausted mortal coil surrenders the ghost, I will have lived my allotted time here without ever directly imbruing my hands in the blood of a fellow human being. But when I'm talking about duels, I'm also talking about bare-knuckle boxing. I remember Walter Williams, the irascible and I think thoroughly commendable Georgetown University economist, was sitting in for Rush Limbaugh, and when Mr. Williams does that, he's a far worthier focus of our attention. This would have been about 20 years ago, a little less than 20 years ago. It was during the early Clinton era. He went down a list of people in Congress whom he considered to be thoroughly disreputable and utterly detestable, Barney Frank et al., and he dilated on their weaknesses and their iniquities at some length and in some detail. And as he did so, he said, listen, if you're offended by this, tell you what, I live in a jurisdiction where dueling is still legal. Do you want to meet me at dawn? Or if you don't like this, how about we go a couple of rounds of bare-knuckle boxing? That's not a threat. It's an invitation. It can be declined, and nobody is injured for it. That's a very important distinction to make here. When this guy is inviting a cop to fight him, he's not threatening that law enforcement officer. But everything police do, never forget this, everything police do is coupled with the threat of immediate lethal violence against those who don't comply. Whether or not compliance is morally, let alone legally justifiable, police are in the business of using the threat of lethal force. And so you're dealing here in the person of Chief Locke with somebody who's a pretty representative specimen of the punitive caste that rules places like Burns Mill, Missouri. I'll talk a little bit more about this on the other side of the break. This is Pro Libertate Radio. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number here on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute. Once again, I really don't think this is a joke, this invitation by Rich Stevens, a former football player. It doesn't mention how successful he was in his career with the Oakland Raiders. Chances are he was in the proverbial show just long enough to have a drink of Gatorade, maybe get a couple of downs. I don't know. Maybe he played longer and had more influence than that. But he played NFL football, which means that he would be, by any definition, part of the athletic elite, at least in terms of his background. And he considers himself to be the victim of police abuse there in this small town of Burns Mill, Missouri. And so he is doing what he can to try to shame the officer who was involved in this episode last July in which Mr. Stevens ended up on the ground and then handcuffed and jailed for no justifiable reason I've been able to learn about. He wants to challenge this guy to a refereed mixed martial arts match. And the question is asked, why don't you file a formal complaint? And, of course, the obvious answer is there's no purpose in filing a formal complaint. You're asking a police department to investigate itself, which, of course, means that you'll have, oh, a not particularly suspenseful, decent interval in which the department exonerates itself. You're actually, I think, likelier to find Frigidaires raining from the skies than to find a circumstance in which a small town police department is going to chasten one of its own in circumstances of the sort Mr. Stevens describes. And so he's going for a more hands-on form of officer accountability. This provoked Ed Locke, the chief of the police department, to describe this invitation to a mixed martial arts match, which Mr. Stevens published in the local newspaper and is publishing by way of a sandwich board sign displayed on his pickup truck, which cost him $160 to get out of the impound, and in a local television interview describes it as a threat against a law enforcement officer. Oh, those poor, timid, cringing souls. Stevens says he would do the mixed martial arts fight by the books on a fight card and sell tickets. I'm taking all the money, donating it to Backstoppers, said Stevens. I just want his head on my hand. There's just a little flavor of the WWE, perhaps, in that phrase. Stevens decided not to file a formal complaint, saying he expects more results his way. I think that's a safe assumption. The police chief says formal complaints are investigated and feels poking fun at the police goes too far. If every officer that pulled someone over and they weren't happy, if they were challenged to a fighting match, certainly those officers would all be suspended or lose their jobs, said Locke. Now, I don't think that's a problem. If you're going to assume that circumstances of that sort mean that the police is losing the mandate of heaven, to use the Chinese expression, or losing the mandate from the local community they supposedly serve, maybe they'd be better off without a police department. Look, one of the things, and this is something I mentioned before, one of the things happening right now amid this economy-wide collapse that we're dealing with, where states, counties, local governments are basically starving for revenue. And, of course, they're always looking for new sources of revenue from the productive class. One of the things that's happening is that there are police departments that are being shut down. And I think that that's a healthy development to the extent that this results in a more decentralized system in which people are more acutely aware of their responsibility to protect themselves. There are, and here comes the standard obligatory ritualistic disclaimer, there are people I know who are police officers, some of them in fairly unlikely or apparently unlikely circumstances, who do good work, who enlisted in law enforcement because of a commendable sense of vocation to protect the innocent against the aggressions of the lawless. There are some who are my age, some who are retired, who are older. There are some who are younger. And the younger ones that I just described are worth their weight in palladium, in my opinion, because they defy the cultural expectations right now. Let me share a quick story with you. This is 2010. Oh, my word. This story is old enough to get a driver's license. About 16 years ago, when I was living in Grand Chute, Wisconsin. Yeah, Grand Chute, not Appleton, it was Grand Chute, Wisconsin. When I was employed at the New American Magazine, I used to go to a place called Club West, which, of course, as its name would signify, was an athletic club. It was a gym. And one of the people I worked out with was about 5 or 6 years younger than I was at the time. He was in his late 20s. Maybe he was a little bit closer to age. Closer to my age. I was 31 at the time. He would have been maybe 28 or 29. And he was working out with me every night. We would spot each other on the bench press and things of that sort because he wanted to get in shape. He wanted to become one of the COPS officers. The COPS program, I don't remember what the acronym stands for, was embedded in the omnibus, or more properly described, ominous crime bill of 1993-1994. Under the Clinton administration, and one of the provisions in that measure called for federal funding to create 100,000 local police positions. They'd be local, once again, only in the geographic sense, because they're funded by the federal government. They would be They would be part of the federal law enforcement apparatus. And so you're dealing here with a situation where they would be playing by the federal government's rules. This is a process that has been in the works now since no later than the mid-1960s. And as I never tire of pointing out, although we can lay a lot of the blame at the feet of LBJ and the Great Society and the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration in the late 1960s, it was the Republican Richard Nixon who really created the momentum for federalizing and militarizing police in the name of the war on drugs. And he did so for the most transparently cynical of reasons. He wanted to create a wedge issue dealing with the conflict between the counterculture and Joe Hardhat, Joe Sixpack, the so-called silent majority. He and his advisors found a cultural fault line. It was at the time they found it, a fissure. They put in their prying instruments and they brought it into a chasm. And one of the ways they did this was by declaring war on drugs. And by declaring war on drugs, you ended up with the federal government subsidizing and supervising local law enforcement. You had a lot of seed money being used scattered around the country to create SWAT teams and counter-narcotics task forces. And within a generation, 1971 to about 1995 or so, you literally saw the rapid amalgamation of elements of the federal government, the military, and local law enforcement through the war on drugs. Ronald Reagan didn't help a whole lot. His CIA veteran Vice President George Bush the Elder was put in charge of the war on drugs, and so you ended up with a bigger drug problem, given that the CIA historically has been the world's largest narcotics syndicate, and you ended up with the larger apparatus to fight that drug problem at the same time. You ended up with organizations like Joint Task Force 6, which was created with Special Forces involvement, that was in charge of carrying out military operations on the American side of the border with Mexico and in the Caribbean Basin. This was something that was supervised by George Bush on Ronald Reagan's watch. And Ronald Reagan managed to carve out a whole collection of exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act. But by 1994, we had a situation where it was just assumed that the federal government had to be in charge of hiring local police. And I spoke with this fellow who wanted to become one of the federally funded police officers, and I described to him in some detail what I'm sharing with you this evening, the constitutional problems and the practical problems with what was going on in law enforcement. And I said that if you're going to be getting a federal grant to become a police officer, you're not going to be serving the local town or village or county where you'll be stationed. You'll be basically a mercenary in the hire of Washington, D.C. And he shrugged his shoulders and said, the money's good. And basically, that's what they pay me to do. That's how I'm going to behave. And I learned some other things about him that left me with the impression that we weren't dealing with the moral paragon here. But he's more or less typical, I'm afraid, of the type of people who are my age, a little bit younger in law enforcement now. So when you find somebody who defies that stereotype, and it's a well-earned stereotype, that's something precious and commendable. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. Stand by for a Remorse Edition after this.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
1-866-986-6397 is our call number, 866-986-6397. And we're talking a little bit about this story out of Burns Mill, Missouri, which is a small town I had never heard of before about a week ago. And once again, to recap what happened last July, there's a fellow who is a former football player who was in a traffic stop that ended up in an arrest. He was assaulted by a police officer. His feet were kicked from beneath him. He ended up on the ground, handcuffed, his car was towed away, he was hauled off to jail. After a couple of days, he was released. No criminal charges were preferred against him. He had to pay $160 to get his car out of impound. He wasn't happy with what had happened. He felt neither protected nor served. So rather than filing a formal complaint, he took out an ad, a full-page ad, in a county newspaper there published in Jefferson County, Missouri. I'm guessing it was probably a weekly newspaper, challenging the police officer who assaulted him to a mixed martial arts fight. Under refereed conditions, the gate would be collected and donated to charity. And he considers this to be a far better way of bringing about some kind of police accountability than filing a formal complaint. Now, in looking into this a little bit more deeply, I found a story from a couple of years ago that seems to validate the concerns that Mr. Stevens, the victim in this encounter, has about the utility of filing a complaint with the police department. This is from July 20th, 2007. That's 3 years and a week or so prior to the episode that I described that occurred at this traffic stop. The public has only heard part of the story about the Burns Mill Police Department, according to Police Chief Ed Locke. Locke and his officers have been the target of a great deal of criticism of late, with much of it generated through a June 28th town hall meeting called by State Representative Michael Frame, who's a Democrat of Eureka. Members of the public were invited to attend the meeting to voice their views pro and con about the department. Frame said he initiated the meeting in response to numerous complaints made to his office about the Burns Mill officers, particularly their behavior during traffic stops. Frame said he did not invite Locke and his officers to the meeting so as not to inhibit people from speaking freely. However, Locke said that that led to people giving incident accounts that either left out information or were misleading in other ways. First, I stand 100% behind my officers and staff, said Locke, 50, who has been the Burns Mill police chief for 6 years and has been with the Burns Mill Police Department since 1997. Locke says he welcomes a move by the Burns Mill Board of Aldermen at a July 18th meeting to purchase cameras for police cars to monitor what goes on during traffic stops. So if your starting position is you stand 100% behind your officers, you're unqualified, your support for your officers, you're starting with the assumption, basically, that if people get together and they're the ones, the citizenry, who are conducting the review, and they're not going to be fair to your police officers, and you stand 100% behind your police officers, I think that you can assume that there's going to be a certain reciprocal protectiveness on the part of his police force by Chief Locke. Now, the citizens don't get to participate when the police conduct an internal review, but he's criticizing the citizens for conducting a public review of the police department in which the police can't participate. And his view is that he stands 100% behind his police officers. You know, color me incurably cynical, but I think Mr. Stevens is onto something when he suggests that it's better to call out the officer to throw down in a refereed mixed martial arts match than it is to seek redress through an internal review on the part of that police department. Brian from Philadelphia has joined us this evening. Good evening, Brian. Welcome to the program. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mr. Gregg. I heard you, mention the Posse Comitatus Act earlier and Reagan.
Yes, sir. Yes, it did.
Yes, I was interested in learning more about that. What's the Posse Comitatus Act?
The Posse Comitatus Act was passed in 1878. It was part of a deal that ended the military occupation of the conquered southern states after the war between the states. What had happened is that during the 1876 presidential election, you ended up going into extra innings. You ended up with a situation where the winner of the popular vote lost the Electoral College vote. And it was really a fairly smelly state of affairs. And in order to placate wounded southern sensibilities and to bring about the enshrinement of a president who didn't carry the South, the politics of the time were such that the Republican Party asked if, in exchange for getting the support of the presidential victor here, I can't remember his name, it'll come to me in a second, if the southern states would be placated by a formal end to the military occupation called Reconstruction. And to that end, there was a measure passed in the House of Representatives and the Senate called Posse Comitatus, and that's Latin, refers to basically the power of the county. And the Posse Comitatus statute forbids the use of active duty military as law enforcement within the United States, wherever you have jurisdictional issue in which the courts are open, and there are civilian law enforcement agencies available, particularly, of course, county sheriffs. You cannot have the National Guard, or for that matter, any other branch of the military, conducting arrests or otherwise carrying out law enforcement functions. The problem is, it's a statute. And so there are exceptions that have been made to that statute, usually through some kind of executive action with respect to, in recent years, weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, chemical weapons, and things of that kind. But way back in the 1980s, the Reagan administration began to issue executive findings holding that the so-called threat of narcotics was so acute that there had to be an exception made to posse comitatus in order to allow the use of the military in an advisory role or in a support role or sometimes in a trigger puller role if you can establish a narcotics nexus to a given law enforcement undertaking. Now, the issue of the narcotics nexus is important because the governor of Texas, Ann Richards, way back in 1992, issued a finding claiming that there was a narcotics nexus to the Branch Davidian community at Mount Carmel. And that's what supposedly justified the involvement of special forces, including the Delta Force, in training the ATF and also being present on April 19th of 1993 in a trigger pulling capacity to consummate the bloodshed there. But that all had to do with things that were set in motion, quite frankly, by Nixon and Reagan with respect to these exceptions to posse comitatus.
Oh, okay. That was very informative.
Well, good. Now, how are things in Philly, I ask with some trepidation.
with Philly?
I've only been there a few times. I've always enjoyed Philly.
It's a lovely city to visit. We try to take care of the tourists. As far as homeland security and that kind
of thing. Yeah.
I don't think that the ATF or even any Delta forces are too involved here with drug enforcement. What we have a lot is trying to violate our Second Amendment rights here in Philadelphia.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I was about 10 years ago on a speaking tour about that issue.
Yeah, reign of John Street, we had a police chief, Sylvester, and he actually, you might want to look into this, I guess they set forth basically death squads to go around Philadelphia, and it was a squad that specifically responded to any gun crimes. And within the first couple weeks, I encourage you to look into this, they shot down at least two people, shot them dead within the first couple weeks, and then that idea was disbanded. They got rid of a lot of those ideas as soon as they got John Street out of the office.
Yeah, I heard some really bad things about John Street and about things that were going on with local law enforcement during that era. One thing I saw recently was a story in which a couple of narcotics undercover officers were detained by, I guess, regular line officers. I think they were uniformed officers rather than detectives, but the two police officers saw these undercover guys, thought that they were drug dealers. They stopped them, and they robbed them at gunpoint, not knowing that they were robbing fellow members of the Philadelphia PD.
Yes.
So they thought they were just boosting a couple of drug dealers, and it turns out that they found out only after the fact that they'd held up a couple of other police officers.
Yeah.
Now that bespeaks a really troubled police department, I'd say.
Absolutely.
Not
and
to put too fine a point on it.
Some members of the police department. I'm actually a mixed martial arts coach here in Philadelphia.
Oh, cool.
And
great.
I heard you talk about that guy calling out the cop out west. We had a fight recently, a boxing match between an ex-cop from our area and Rodney King.
Really? How did that turn out?
What's that?
How did that turn out?
I think Rodney King beat him down.
Really?
Yeah.
Sweet revenge. Cool. Brian, do you want to hang with us for the break? You finished?
I'm finished. I'm going to listen to the rest of the show.
Okay. Thanks so much for calling in. You take care. It's good to hear from you. God bless. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back at you in just a minute. Bye. Once again, I find myself grateful for my audience. Attentive listener just sent me a link to the NFL statistics page for Richard Stevens. 45 years old. He was born on New Year's Day, 1965. He's from St. Louis. He went to college in Tulsa. He played for 5 years, all with the Raiders, first in Los Angeles and then in Oakland. His last year, he didn't get any playing time. He didn't get any playing time his third year either. Let me think here. Actually, there are only two seasons, according to this anyway, that he got any playing time, but he played 16 games in 1993 and 13 games in 1995, and he started a game in each season. So he started a total, forgive me, he started a total of two games, but he played 29 games in the NFL. You know, that's a lot of downs. So I don't know if there's a statistics record here. What position did he play? He's a big guy. It looks like he might have been a defensive end or something. That doesn't say much about his statistical record. Point is, he made the grade. He made the cut. He put out. He sweat. He bled. He played. He's worthy of at least a little bit of respect for that. Now, Brian, or is it Ryan? Brian from Philadelphia. Forgive me, Brian. I don't want to give the impression that I am deprecating your call because I couldn't remember your name. Brian from Philadelphia, who just called, pointed out that Rodney King, the notorious Rodney King, managed to do something akin to what Mr. Stevens wants to do, and that is that he got into the competitive arena, the pugilistic arena, with a police officer. This is from September 16th. This time, Rodney King wants to do the hitting. Sort of a tasteless way to start the story. Before he walks down the aisle to marry a juror from his trial, the 44-year-old has told RaiderOnline.com that he wants to meet Mike Tyson for a boxing bout. 3 one-minute rounds at a Las Vegas casino. I'm in great shape, King told RadarOne.com in an exclusive interview. My trainer, Marty Feldman, has been training me really hard, and if it happens, people will be surprised. I don't know if that's exactly what he meant to say, but I saw a photograph of the guy, and quite frankly, he is in really good shape. He's in great shape for somebody who's 44. He's in great shape for somebody who's 14. He has abdominals that make him look like he's implanted a lobster in his abdomen. Okay, now this is from September 13th of last year. Rodney King beats cop in boxing match. This is a new chapter of my life, King said in a statement. Rodney King won this round against the cops unanimously. The 44-year-old, I guess he's 45 now, who's beating at the hands of white LAPD officers, it's not really helpful to point out that he was black and they were white, and presumably all of them are the same ethnic makeup now that they were in 1991. Just say that you're dealing with somebody who was on the receiving end of unlawful force in the course of what was a legitimate arrest. I mean, Rodney King was legitimately arrested. I'm not going to say that the beating was legitimate, but the arrest certainly was. The 44-year-old who's beating at the hands of LAPD officers of irrelevant ethnicity, who were later acquitted, sparked deadly race riots in Los Angeles nearly two decades ago, was the unanimous winner in a celebrity boxing match outside of Philadelphia. This is a new chapter of my life, King said after the fight. According to a statement, I am sober, fit, and now a winner. King took on ex-cop Simon the Renegade, I believe it's pronounced Awad, 31, at the Philadelphia Airport Ramada Inn in three rounds and drew a crowd of about 500 fans, according to the New York Post. The 6-foot, 215-pound tattooed Awad, who worked as an officer outside of Philly, came to the fight with a 36-0 record and 34 knockouts. The 6-foot-4, 250-pound King trained for the fight by sparring, hitting bags, and jumping rope, according to the Post. It's interesting. He's a novice fighter. I know some people will see the irony here, but I would have fought anyone who was worthy, King said before the fight. I take this very seriously. Never felt better physically and in the mind. The three-round match was sponsored by Celebrity Boxing. Now, assuming here that Mr. Awad, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's obviously an Arabic name. Assuming that he didn't get paid to take a dive here, and he didn't take a dive. Apparently, it was a unanimous decision. I don't know if he ever hit the canvas. Assuming that, anyway, he was actually beat, that's a pretty impressive accomplishment for a 44-year-old guy who's a novice boxer to beat somebody with a 36-0 record and 34 knockouts. Now, the fact that he had 34 knockouts does suggest that he was probably beating on a bunch of tomato cans, but once again, if you get inside the ring and actually let the fists fly and you catch a few and you deliver a few, you're worthy of respect. It doesn't really matter whether you're talking about people who are accomplished or not. He fought 36 times and, or forgive me, fought 36 times and knocked out 34 of them. That's an accomplishment, just as it's an accomplishment for a 44-year-old guy to beat a guy 13 years his junior with a record like that. So I guess good for Rodney King, and I certainly hope that he's straightening out his life. It's not been really one of the more stellar lives of recent American history, but you know, there is such a thing as a second act and a third act, and I do think that the fact that he's cleaned up his life, he's sober, he's fit, he's staying out of trouble. He was a repeat offender on charges having to do with vehicular mayhem and actually endangering the lives of others or injuring other people. I think that he seems to have settled down and he's making a good life for himself. And there's a certain element, I suppose, of conceptual payback in that outcome. And the fact that it occurred in a refereed fight means that nobody was seriously hurt. That means that somebody was defeated and there was pain inflicted, but this isn't a situation where somebody is trying to hurt somebody else, but rather to defeat the individual. So I think that worked out pretty well. Going to take a brief digression here, or at least go in a different direction. There's an item that was posted this afternoon at lourockwell.com on the blog describing a tea party engagement that was attended by a fellow by the name of Tyler Smith. And I'm going to read this to you, and I'm probably going to elaborate on the themes from this item on the other side of the hour here. I'm currently at a tea party rally, wrote Mr. Smith, texting in media res, at the encouragement of a family member. I thought a bit of play-by-play might be fun. The way it has unfolded so far, a prayer, mostly lauding the war dead, then a moment of silence for another recent victim of the Iraq atrocity. Victim, of course, refers to somebody in an American uniform. When I didn't stand or remove my cap for the National Declaration of Adoration, also known as the Pledge of Allegiance, I got a few dirty looks. By the way, I get dirty looks, too, when I don't participate in the Pledge of Allegiance. The reason why I don't is because I only recognize one liege. I have one liege lord, and I pledge unconditional allegiance to him. But as I understand it, if there's a claim to be made in terms of subordination in my relationship to the supposed republic, the republic exists to serve and protect my rights. I don't exist to the benefit of those who preside over the republic. 20 minutes into it, every two-bit local politician has made his patriotic fervor known on the stage. Then a woman with a beautiful voice stands and sings "To God Be the Glory," followed by the most deranged version of "Change Our Heart, O God," mutated with the Pledge of Allegiance inserted in the middle. Then the hymn transitioned into "God Bless America." Again, everyone was told to stand. More dirty looks my way. When did this gathering advertised as a rally for economic sanity turn into a state church? The Secretary of State spoke briefly about his current initiative to require all voters to have a valid, presumably federal, ID to vote. They now have a 12-year-old boy reading about the importance of caring for the war ruined with tax money. Also about the importance of using our tax dollars to pay for the retired generation. He wrapped up by advertising for Americans for Youth Patriotism. Yes, indoctrinate a new generation of hosts for the parasitic state. I'm sad to say that this rally has nothing to do with liberty or decreasing the tax burden on the American populace. And that, by the way, I interject at this point, is a really good diagnosis of the bait and switch that has been played with the Tea Party movement, which started out as a movement to decentralize power, to reduce the involvement of government in our lives, to reduce the economic burden of government. It began as an outgrowth of Ron Paul's campaign to end the Fed and end the imperial state. Now it's become just an adjunct of the Republican Party, of the militarist, hyper-nationalist, punitive populist wing of the Republican Party. Here's an update from Kevin Patrick Kelly on the same subject. I know exactly how Tyler feels. Most of the Tea Party meetings that I go to are filled with people wanting to spread the word of God and Christianity overseas to those brown people. I had one elderly woman lecture me on how I was against the troops if I didn't go along with the mass killings overseas. Another individual lectured me on how it was our duty to instill conservative values into our school children. By conservative values, does he mean more obedience to the state and its draconian policies? It is amazing how a wonderful movement that was started by Ron Paul and his presidential campaign has now been dwarfed into a movement with Bible-thumping conservatives who want to spread the word of God overseas by force and hope to relive the glory days of George W. Bush. Tragic. It is indeed tragic. Potentially a world historic tragedy, given the missed opportunity this represents. Nothing at all wrong with wanting to share the gospel with people, but this is not done at the point of a bayonet or a bomb. And really, isn't that the same thing that the Mohammedans supposedly are trying to do to us? Is it really, as one general said, a matter of our God is bigger than their God? Well, the point is, I'm not afraid of them, because the God I worship is bigger than all of us. And he's not going to be introduced effectively to people by threatening to kill them if they don't genuflect at altars of our designation. Thus ends Hour 1 of Pro Libertate for this evening. Hour 2 will be upon us ere long. Join us in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned here at LibertyNewsRadio.com or at your local affiliate. 866-986-6397 is our call number. I'll be back with you in just a minute.